Great. Well, good morning. Can you all hear me okay? I should apologise for my voice. I don't normally sound quite so much like Barry White. Last week I was winning a battle against a cold and I thought I'd won. And I thought I'd really nailed it yesterday, and then I got up and it was, they were right down there. So yesterday I said at church, I don't think I'm infectious anymore. Somebody said, how does he know? And so I will try and keep my distance. But I'd value your prayers and my voice holds up. You have, I hope, got one of these little handouts in front of you. And I want to just talk you briefly through the whole shape of it, because it will help us to just get a feel for where we're going in the next couple of hours as we think about this subject of science and Christianity. I'm aware that... thank you very much, that's great. I'm aware that... people come to this subject from a range of different backgrounds. So some of you will have, in fact I know some of you have backgrounds in the sciences. You have degrees or high degrees in the sciences. Others of you will have mild heart palpitations at the mere thought of a Bunsen burner, and the thought of spending 2 hours thinking about science and Christianity is a bit daunting. I want to try and give you all value for money. So what I'm actually going to try and do is to zip through things quite quickly in a kind of summary form so that we have plenty of time for questions, and I hope that as we do that we'll be able to get a sense of where we all are and what will be the most helpful issues to pursue in a bit more detail. I also realise that there are some issues which, well, let me tell you a story. Somebody just mentioned, said on the way here, I won't tell you who it is, on the way here we were talking about this seminar in the car, and we realised this is one of those subjects where the speaker has the potential to offend everybody. Really? Thank you for the poison chalice, Mark. And of course I think what the chap in fact is what he was referring to, he was thinking about the issue of the doctrine of creation, Genesis 1, the chronology or whatever of Genesis 1, and some of the heated debates that sometimes take place within Christian circles about that subject, and I suspect we have the whole range of views in the room here, which is going to be interesting, because that's really helpful for evangelism, to hear the Christians arguing about their Bible. Now, it's not that I want to dismiss those discussions, far from it. If you look down at your contents page on the front page of the handouts, point 7 out of 8, so not quite at the bottom, but point 7 out of 8 is Genesis chapter 1 and 2 and the creation of the universe. I hope we have a chance to get to that. But what I really want to emphasise, especially in the first portion of our time together, is the vast amount of other things there are to think about. Especially in the context of speaking to men and women such as yourselves who are Christian ministers, people who are focused on the task of Christian ministry, people who are constantly meeting new folks in your churches or young Christians with questions, who are your friends in home groups or your friends next door, evangelistic opportunities that open up where this issue becomes significant. I want to equip you not to have better arguments among yourselves about the chronology of the days of Genesis 1, although, as I said, I think that's a significant issue. I hope we get to it. Primarily, I want to do what it says in the little grey box at the top of page 1. Here's what it says. I want to equip you to demonstrate that an unashamedly Trinitarian, evangelical, reformed Christian faith is not only compatible with the best modern science, but actually makes more sense of the world around us than atheist science does. And there is a huge amount of stuff to talk about. Just let me scan through the handout briefly. There's a range of issues, the numbered points from 1 down to 8, that I hope we'll have time to touch upon. And then from page 8 onwards, really what I'm hoping to give you is stuff which will help you to write and prepare talks, blog posts, evangelistic material for yourselves. So briefly, what I've got on page 8 are some suggested talk outlines. I've got some, just flip over to page 8 and you can have a quick look at them. These are talks that I've given, and I request please that you listen to my talk if you want to rip off anything from it. Strip out all the rubbish, that'll create plenty of spare time for you to add your own more entertaining illustrations and more apposite demonstrations of the points you want to make. And then just use this stuff, none of it's copyright. I would love to see on the email letters that I get from the Gospel Partnerships and so on, reports of people, we ran this evangelistic event and our vicar spoke at it. And he gave this talk about XYZ, and we had half a dozen people there who weren't Christians. That would be fabulous. I'd love to see. So please feel free to butcher, use, reproduce word for word, or just pull out one or two illustrations from all that material on page 8. To help you with that, there are four appendices from pages 9 through to 11, which give you some of the stuff that kind of adds colour to talks, really. There's one fairly extended argument, which I'm going to give you in outline, on pages 9 and the start of page 10, in relation to the fine-tuning of the universe and the improbability, the staggering improbability that this universe arose by chance. Then there's a bunch of quotes. Quotes, of course, don't prove anything at all, but they often serve to set the scene for a talk, don't they? If you can find a couple of quotes from atheists and Christians and a Christian scientist or two, you know, it just helps to add colour to some of the material that I hope you'll go away and present to some of the folks in your churches and outside them. And then there's a fascinating and I think quite revealing quotation from an atheist evolutionary biologist, Richard Lewontin, verse 11, where he really gives the game away about what's actually at stake in the debate between materialism, which I'll define shortly, and religion in general, and the Christian faith in particular. So, no need to read all that stuff now, obviously, but take it away, and I hope that will save you from frantically scribbling down all of the numbers, trying to keep up with the things I'm saying in a few minutes' time. I want to save you that labour so that we can engage with each other and listen and so on. So, let's begin, if you wouldn't mind flipping over to page 2. What I want to do is to work through as many of these 8 issues as I can to highlight ways in which the Christian faith, particularly an evangelical, reformed, robustly Trinitarian understanding of the Christian faith, makes more sense of the world than an atheist scientific worldview does. Let's start then by clarifying the clash of worldviews that we're talking about. We are not talking about the relationship between science and religion, or between science and Christianity even, really. Science is a wonderful and good thing, and if we get as far as point 8, we'll see that it arose very largely in the Reformation and post-Reformation period from Christian convictions about the way the world works. We are dealing, rather, with two incompatible and competing views of the world. Reductive materialism and theism. Let me just define what those worldviews are, and once I've explained it, you'll think, yeah, I recognise that. Reductive materialism is the view that the world and all that is in it can be explained on the basis of the interaction between matter and perhaps matter and energy. Matter and energy are the only things that exist. The way that matter and energy behave can be, so to speak, described or is encoded in laws which can be written down which describe the behaviour of the world around us, and there's nothing else to consider. In other words, reductive materialism is a claim that there is nothing beyond the physical world that surrounds us. Theism, and this will be familiar to you, by contrast, is the claim that there exists beyond this world the creator of this world, who holds this world in being. The God who made all things didn't just make it and then walk away. That's deism. He made it and he holds it together and keeps it working in a particular way. And the laws which physicists and chemists and biologists observe in the material world around them are actually a manifestation of God's faithfulness in upholding the world in the way that he does. The reason that, for example, gravity can be described by a fairly simple equation, a law, the law of gravity, the reason that can be described in that simple way is because God is faithful in making things interact in a certain way, and he does that because he's kind to us. It would be really annoying having to live in a universe where gravity kept changing. And so God is kind, and so he wants rain to fall, you know, regularly enough for us to grow plants and so on and so forth. He sustains the world in a predictable and organised way. That God who made this physical world, theism further claims, also made non-physical things like angels and like minds which will occupy us a little bit shortly. Angels not so much, but minds certainly. But you can see where the clash lies. Both materialists and theists, we're theists, I take it. We have one or two non-Christians here, coming with friends and guests, well, most welcome. I'm anticipating most of us are Christian theists. Agree that there's a physical world out here which works in a kind of scientific way and can be explained and explored scientifically. Materialism denies that there is anything else. And what I want to show you is that denial means there's plenty of stuff that a materialist can't explain. That make sense so far? Okay, good. Now, what's going on in these first two points, actually the stuff about the human mind kind of belongs in between theism and the next point. So what I want to do really is just to skip down to point two and to talk to you about the human mind. Because remember, what we've just said about materialism has great relevance here. If a materialist is trying to explain the mind, that is, consciousness, feelings, emotions, desires, thought, rationality, if a materialist is trying to explain that, he or she cannot give an account of it which rests on anything else apart from physical things, because that's all he or she believes exist. Let me summarise by reading this box out to you, where we've come from in getting to the point that we're now at, where materialism has arisen from, and that will help us to see why the very existence of the human mind and human consciousness poses a problem for materialism. Let me read this box. This is a helpful summary, I think. Modern science owes its phenomenal success to a self-conscious decision by 17th century philosophers and scientists to distinguish between material phenomena, such as physical and chemical interactions, and non-material phenomena, such as mind and consciousness. Only the former, they believed, could be investigated with the newly emerging scientific methods. Unfortunately, many modern scientists seem unaware of this. They either overlook the importance of the mind, or seek to explain it in material terms, or even claim that material phenomena are the only things that exist, which means that the mind doesn't exist at all. This worldview is known as reductive materialism. But today, philosophers are increasingly recognizing that the mind cannot be explained in materialist terms. Science needs a new way of understanding the natural world, which accounts for both material and non-material phenomena, and the Christian worldview has the capacity to provide this. So in summary, atheist materialism dominates the scientific world, but it's increasingly encountering problems that it can't solve, especially regarding the mind. And if we were Christian theists, we'd have the capacity to fix this. Now let me unpack that a little bit. It's quite dense, deliberately so. Let me try and unpack it a little bit. Where does reductive materialism come from? Remember what reductive materialism is? This matter and energy is all that exists. Where does it come from? What happened was that in the 17th century, people like Galileo and Descartes made a decision to start investigating the world in a new way. What they'd realised was that the newly emerging scientific methods, things like really, really good high quality lenses, which allowed you to see small things or to measure astronomical objects much more precisely, newly emerging scientific methods gave us access to some phenomena in the world, physical phenomena. But they didn't give us access into all phenomena. You can't measure consciousness with a microscope. It's a category difference. You see the point about that? So what they said was, and you get this really clearly in, if you read, and it's not actually that long, read Descartes' the sixth book thing? Oh, I forgot the name of it. Meditations on First Philosophy, thank you, yeah. In, I think it's book 5 or book 6, he distinguishes between physical phenomena and mental phenomena of the mind. And he says, well, let's put the mind stuff to one side for the time being. We'll have to come back to that later. And what we'll do is we'll focus our attention on mathematical and scientific explorations of physical things. people like Galileo and then the pioneers of what became known later as the scientific revolution exploded into life, because of course scientific experimentation and scientific analysis and mathematical analysis are phenomenally good at analysing material things. I mean, this world is unimaginably more technologically advanced than even 20 years ago. And mind 300, 400 years ago. So we've seen this spectacular progress in the sciences. But something else has happened. What's happened today, and especially since the middle of the 20th century, but more and more recently, some people have forgotten the history. They've forgotten that back in the 17th century, Galileo and Descartes said, yes, there is this immaterial world, the mind, the consciousness. We believe in God, who's immaterial. There is all that stuff, but we don't have the tools to deal with it yet. Let's focus our attention over here on the material world. They've forgotten that, and instead, they treat this material world as if it's the only thing that exists. The proof that it's the only thing that exists is that it's the only thing that their scientific experimentation qualifies them and enables them to detect. Well, who knew? Well, Galileo knew. Which is the reason why he and Descartes and their contemporaries put to one side issues of the mind and consciousness, knowing that one day they'd have to come back to them. So now what you have is a really fascinating situation, because you've got reductive materialists like Peter Atkins, former professor of chemistry in Oxford, might still be in Oxford, saying there's no reason to believe that science, reductive materialist science, cannot deal with every aspect of existence. Every aspect of existence. He thinks this part of it, matter, is the whole. At the same time, you've got atheist, or certainly non-Christian philosophers saying, hold on a second, just wait. Because we know, our history of philosophy, there's a whole category of things like the mind, consciousness, emotions, desires and so on, which are fascinating, which we know that scientific tools were never set up to investigate. So what's going to happen in the next few years is going to be quite interesting. Where we are now is we've rediscovered what Descartes called the mind-body problem. We know there's this material stuff, we also know now there's this mind stuff, we have no idea how they relate. The history of philosophy since Descartes has been the failure to solve the mind-body problem, pretty much. Well, that's a bit of a simplification. But what's happened now is people are just fascinated by what the mind is. And if you read popular science journals, you'll find loads and loads and loads of articles all about how the mind works and what the mind is and whether we can measure the brain and kind of get access into what the mind does. People are fascinated by it. What they don't realise is, many of these guys don't realise, that the whole scientific enterprise, ever since the scientific revolution, was only ever designed to deal with everything apart from the mind. So that means, if you want access to the mind, this thing that fascinates you, you're going to have to change your whole way of looking at the world. It will not be good enough just to design a slightly smarter brain scanner. Your worldview needs to be superseded. You need to abandon this temporary compromise materialism and come up with something else. Now, I'm not a prophet or a son of a prophet, but I will tell you how I think this is going to happen. We're on now the fourth little bullet point down. How will materialism be superseded? How is this worldview, which dominates the scientific establishment, going to be done away with? Let me tell you a lesson from history. Where's my glass on? Excuse me. Has anybody ever come across a book by a chap called Thomas Kuhn called On the Structure of Scientific Revolutions? Yes, one, two, three or four hands. Yeah, great. This was an epoch-making book in the middle of the 20th century. And what Thomas Kuhn did was to describe how scientific progress takes place. Here's what he said happens. First, you get gradual, steady progress within a particular field. Or maybe it's astronomy, say. Particle physics. Gradual, steady progress. And as you make progress, you're learning more and more things. But you're also discovering more and more problems that don't quite fit the paradigm, don't quite fit your theory, can't be explained by your way of viewing the world. And what you do is you think, well, we'll put that problem off, we'll push it off ahead of us and come to it later. And these problems build up like snow in front of a snowplow. And as you're kind of ploughing on, you're pushing quite a lot of snow out of the way, but you're also gathering a whole bunch of snow in front of the windscreen, which refuses to go away. Yeah, your snowplow has missed it. And eventually, you get to the point where these anomalies, so-called, gets so glaring, so big, that people start to say, hold on, maybe this whole approach to the discipline doesn't work. Or at least doesn't work comprehensively. You reach what Thomas Kuhn called a crisis. A period of revolutionary science, where people stop trying just to drive the snowplow faster, and instead they say, you know what, we need to just do away with this, good though it has been, and replace it with something bigger, smarter, something different, a different way of looking at the world. A revolution. A change of paradigm, he called it. And that's what happened when, for example, Einstein developed his theories of special and general relativity. It's what happened with quantum mechanics. It's what happened with Copernicus back in the late Middle Ages, with the shift in perspective from a geocentric to a heliocentric universe. It was no longer good enough to just try and take more and more accurate measurements of the movements of the planets and do your sums slightly better within a Earth-centered model of the universe. People finally realise it just doesn't work. So you abandon the paradigm and replace it with something new. Now, how do you think that feels for the scientists who are invested in the current paradigm? Right, exactly. Life's work, all about to be revealed as, at the very least, built on a foundation which is going to be viewed with disdain. It's going to be part of the antiquated history of science quite soon. Huh? It doesn't feel great. So what happens is, when the way you can spot a paradigm shift approaching is two things. First, you get this big accumulation of anomalies, unexplained things, like the fact that the mind is fascinating and we have no idea what it is or how it works. Huge anomaly. Then second, you get enormous opposition to the very idea of a paradigm shift. That's what happens. You get all the problems building up, and then all the people who work for the company that manufactured that snowplow say, no, this is fine, just stick a bigger engine in, buy a sort of booster modification to make it drive faster and push more snow out of the way. You get an enormously strong counter-reaction, and that is exactly what you see in the history of science. You saw it before before the revolution of general and special relativity with Einstein. Lord Kelvin in 1900 famously said this. Lord Kelvin, great famous physicist, after him is named the temperature scale that starts at absolute zero. Zero Kelvin is like minus 273, that's right. Lord Kelvin said this in 1900, there is nothing new to be discovered in physics now. And the fascinating thing is, he's not alone. Similar things were said 25 years earlier by Heinrich Hertz, he of, you know, kilohertz, megahertz, him. Simon Newcomb, Albert Michelson, Michelson-Morley experiment, come across that? One or two kind of vague remembering from some lecture some time ago. He said, the more important physical laws and facts of physical science have all been discovered. It's kind of embarrassing when you say that, and 11 years later, a young man named Albert Einstein publishes on the electrodynamics of moving bodies. Oops. Because it just completely blows not just your statement and your theory, but the whole paradigm out of the water. Enormous opposition results when somebody comes along and says, it's not just that you're wrong, it's that the ground you're standing on needs to shift. Because people who are standing on ground like that don't like to be told that kind of thing. So you get this intense hostility to the new paradigm, intense hostility to the very idea that reductive materialism might be wrong. Does that remind you of anything? What have we seen in the last 10 or 15 years? You've seen a growing awareness that there are anomalies, especially concerning the mind, actually, if you've done any of the reading in the literature, that can't be explained, and then an intense hostility from the new atheist crowd and others to the very idea that reductive materialism might be wrong. So I suspect what's going to happen, this paradigm is going to shift pretty dramatically, probably sometime in the next 20 to 50, maybe 60, 70 years. And people are going to have to embrace something else. Something which will actually make sense of not just all the stuff we've done so far, but this stuff about the mind that we haven't done yet. Now, actually, for a Christian theist, that's not too difficult. Yeah? Christians have been thinking for a long time about what the mind or the soul is, about where it comes from, about how it relates to the body and so on. It's not that popular in the Christian theological literature, but there's stuff out there. And Christian theism has the resources to preserve all the stuff which is good about materialism, the basis of experimental method and science and so on, whilst at the same time explaining the mind as well. It seems to me that will be one of the leading contenders for the new paradigm when this one finally implodes. You have my permission to make that prediction. Okay, so that's the first two thoughts, just trying to set the stage and setting up one of the major areas where I think it's perfectly reasonable to say, here is where the Christian faith can make a contribution to our scientific understanding that an atheist materialist cannot. Happy so far? Let me play on with a couple more, try and do these a bit more quickly, and then we shall perhaps pause for questions and so on. Flip over the page to page 3. And we turn to the subject of ethics and morality. Remember, what we're trying to do is to show that a Christian theist can give a more comprehensive, persuasive account of how the world works than an atheist materialist can. Yeah, make sense? Well, we are part of this world, and we have what we call moral values. So, a comprehensive scientific vision of the world ought to be able to explain what ethics is, what values are, where they come from, why moral values have the kind of character and shape that they do. It's a reasonable question to put to scientists, why, on scientific grounds, is murder such a bad idea? Fascinating thing, you see some of the, again, the new atheist crowd realising that this is a question they've got to answer. People like Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, writing books about a scientific basis for moral values. Let me tell you how they've got on. Here's a little summary from the top of that page. These little grey box summaries, by the way, are designed to slow me down a bit and hopefully to give you a kind of, in a nutshell, summary of what I want to say for the next few minutes. So, here goes. Atheism has never provided a compelling basis for constructing moral norms. And indeed, the very existence of human moral awareness poses serious difficulties for atheism. This constitutes a serious shortcoming in materialism's attempt to provide a comprehensive explanation of the natural world. The Christian faith, by contrast, provides a clear explanation for the origin of moral awareness and a coherent basis for constructing moral norms. Which means, in summary, the Christian faith can explain the origin of moral awareness and provide a basis for moral norms, moral rules, rights and wrongs, whereas atheistic materialism cannot. Let me flesh that out a little bit and try and give you some of the, philosophical categories that you might find it helpful to frame this in. It's helpful to distinguish between two views of right and wrong, which some philosophers call moral realism and moral subjectivism. You'll find this sort of thing if you read Thomas Nagel's book Mind and Cosmos. It's in the bibliography. He's not a Christian, actually. He's a monist. He's a strange character, really, Thomas Nagel. He's a philosopher who has done a lot of work on the mind, and he's highlighted all the shortcomings of materialistic views of the mind. He also writes on morality, and in his book Mind and Cosmos, hard going but well worth reading, he'll cash these out in a bit more detail. Let me summarise what I mean by them. Ask yourself the question, what kind of moral sense do we possess? What does it mean for us to think that some things are right and some things are wrong? And most people want to retain some form of what we might call moral realism. What that means is some things are right and some things are wrong, and the rightness or wrongness of those things is not dependent on your opinion of it. Make sense? Right and wrong, and it just is right and wrong, regardless of whether you can find some guy out there who thinks something different. You would concede the possibility that you're wrong, but you would not concede the possibility that if you're wrong, then the truth of the moral judgment changes. You think morality, so to speak, stands outside of us. Morality has a real existence independent of people who have opinions about them. So, for example, we all think, I hope, that murder, if properly defined, is just wrong. And if we could find some guy who thought that the murder he committed was okay, then he's wrong too. You know, murder is not okay for him because he thinks it's okay. this is familiar, especially if you've moved in student circles, because people have had these discussions for years and years and years in relation to issues like postmodernism and so on. And postmodernism is where moral subjectivism has found its latest incarnation. Moral subjectivism is the contrasting view. Moral subjectivism says there are different moral rights and wrongs for different people at different times, in different places, in different circumstances, in different cultures. What's right and wrong just depends critically on our opinions about it. Now, what they're not saying is, well, there's a difference between murdering somebody in cold blood and murdering somebody in self-defense by accident. Okay, a moral realist would agree there's a difference there, right? A moral realist agrees that if you accidentally kill somebody because you're trying to defend yourself against him stabbing you in the head and he falls over and hurts himself, that's not the same as if you deliberately tried to stab him. We're not talking about that kind of difference of opinion. We're talking about an analysis of the same action by two different people. A moral subjectivist would say right and wrong will depend on what those two different people think. If one thinks yes, the other thinks no, then it's yes for him and no for him. There's nothing outside of them which gives a grounding to moral rightness or wrongness. Sound familiar? Yeah, thought so. Okay, so let me illustrate the problem with moral subjectivism. Most of us intuitively have a feeling that there's something wrong with it, but let me illustrate it with what I like to call the problem of the philosophical burglar. I've never been burgled by a philosophical burglar. Anyway, suppose you go home after lunch today and you discover that your flat has been burgled. But not completely burgled. The burglar is still there. He's in the process of unscrewing your 58-inch plasma screen TV from the wall of your nice little Bijou studio apartment here in Linfield. And you say, quite reasonably, I think, would you mind getting out and leaving my stuff alone? That's my TV you're unscrewing there. And he says, ah, I perceive that you're a moral realist. You see where I'm going with this. I, on the other hand, am a moral subjectivist, and I regard stealing your stuff as a good thing, a perfectly right thing. It's mine because I think it's okay, because I think it's mine. Now, let's suppose that you were, like him, a moral subjectivist. What are you going to say? The interesting thing is, there's nothing that you could say to him that he couldn't just repeat back to you. But with the "it's right" rather than "it's wrong" tagged on the end of it. Because morality is entirely constructed by you. So if you're talking to somebody, just thinking, I think this is a great illustration to use. If you're talking to non-Christians, I use it evangelistically all the time. Give a talk, yeah? Where I talk about right and wrong and the Christian view of God. Yeah, or something more provocative. I don't know, think of something more provocative than that. At your local pub or something like this. And the illustration of the philosophical burglar. And keep pressing them. What are you going to say to the burglar unless you think there's such a thing as right and wrong, which, so to speak, transcends both of you? There's nothing you can say unless you can appeal to a higher authority. What that means, actually, in practice, and this is, I think, the devastating consequence of moral subjectivism, how do conflicts like that get resolved? If people don't agree on a moral realist view, and if they don't agree on the standard to which they should subject themselves, what actually happens? What's going to happen if you go home and find a burglar in your house? What are you going to do?
The stronger man wins.
Right. The stronger man wins. Ethics reduces to power. That's what happens when moral realism is abandoned. So let's think, for example, of some societies in the world today where there isn't any coherent history of a single moral framework guiding the development of that society. If you write down the list of countries in which that's the case, and then you write down next to it a list of the countries in which female genital mutilation still takes place on a large scale, guess what you find? And you talk to the men responsible, and they will tell you, well, this is just part of our culture. How dare you interfere with our cultural heritage, you imperialist Brit. Really, seriously. Go to Somalia, go to Mogadishu. There is no history there of a coherent, widely accepted, single moral realist framework being accepted. So the stronger men kill the weak, or the stronger men mutilate the women, or whatever it is. That's just what happens. Ethics disappears and turns into a contest of power. That's the inevitable consequence of abandoning some kind of moral realist stance. Now, that's exactly the problem you've got if you're a reductive materialist. If you're a reductive materialist, remember what you said. You said this world just is matter and energy, matter and energy, let's say. Is there a higher mind who could embrace and impose and enforce an ethical standard to which we're all accountable? No, there couldn't be. There's no such thing as a higher mind if you're a reductive materialist. A reductive materialist is just left with the contest, the power thing. That's all. A Christian theist, of course, can say, no, we're accountable morally to the one upon whom we depend ontologically for our existence. Ethics and being go hand in hand. We receive our being from God, therefore we receive our moral norms from God. And just as we are dependent on him for existence, so we are accountable to him ethically and morally. Now, you might not, you're talking to a bunch of non-Christians now, you might not like the ethics of the Bible, although I suspect you'd probably like quite a lot of them if you took the trouble to read what they say. But at least we Christians have a basis for constructing such a system. What's yours? Turn the heat up a little bit. Let's not be apologetic for believing in the ethics of the scriptures. At least we have an ethical system. It seems to me that's a glaring, creaking, crashing, grinding shortcoming of atheistic materialist worldview. There's no basis for explaining how human beings behave or how they ought to. That's number three. Number four. It's quarter to 20 to 11. I think what I might just go through this and then we'll pause. We might have 10 minutes or so at the end for questions. Does that sound like a good idea? And then it's coffee time. Is that a good idea, Mark? So what we'll do is turn to another, in one sense, unrelated issue, but it's related in the sense that this is another feature of the world around us that an atheist, materialist worldview cannot explain. Cosmic fine-tuning and the origin of the universe. Which, in case that sounds a bit baffling, let me explain. The grey box at the top of the page. Materialism can't explain why the physical world should be intelligible to the human mind. Indeed, if the values of the physical constants that describe the behaviour of our universe differed even slightly from their present values, the universe would be completely uninhabitable and might not even exist at all. The universe appears to be deliberately designed to support life, which is very hard to explain in the absence of a cosmic designer. So in summary, the Christian doctrine of creation, by contrast, unlike atheist materialism, can explain why the universe is intelligible to us and how it came to exist in the first place. What I need you to do now, I need to ask you to imagine. And I know for some of you this will be an unpleasant experience for a moment or two, but you'll get over it. I need to ask you to imagine that you were an atheist, and moreover an atheist who accepted the standard picture of the origin of our universe, which goes a bit like this. 13.7 billion years ago, the Big Bang happened, before which we... and... Stephen Hawking has found a really neat way of avoiding that question, by the way. I'm not persuaded myself, but anyway. About 4 and a bit billion years ago, the Earth was formed, and after that, biological life, which is basically made of carbon and water, started to appear. Hand-waving, you can tell. Yeah. But that's basically the picture you have. 13.7 billion years ago, universe, Big Bang. 4 and a bit billion years ago, the Earth. Okay, imagine you believed that. Well, it turns out that the precise values of the physical constants which describe the behaviour of all that matter are, in our universe, exactly right to allow the universe to exist, stars to form, planets to form, life to exist in a world like ours. And that if they were even slightly different, then either life wouldn't be possible, or planets wouldn't form, or maybe even the universe wouldn't exist at all. Remember, the picture we're thinking of is one in which we can describe the physical world with basically a bunch of equations. Okay, those equations have numbers in them, physical constants, which describe the relationship between different properties. Like there's a constant that describes the relationship between the mass of two bodies and the distance between them. on the one hand, and the force, the gravitational force between them on the other. There's just a constant in there, just think of it as a number. Well, if those values, if you tweak the values even slightly, it turns out the universe wouldn't work. And what's helpful to do is what I've tried to do for you in the appendix at the back, and I'll run through briefly now, is to just to get a handle on how eerily, precisely fine-tuned these physical constants are. I encourage you not to look at the appendix at the back, because you can just rip that off and preach it, you know, some other time. But let's have some fun for 5 minutes before we go to questions. I'll give you a few examples. By the way, if at any point you don't understand any of the complicated words, don't worry. I'll get to some numbers in a minute, and you might not understand them either, but I'm going to explain what they mean, and then we'll have some fun. If the ground state energy levels of beryllium and helium nuclei differed by more than about 1% from their present values, the universe wouldn't contain any carbon. Don't worry about what those ground state thingy, what's it, are. But imagine yourself, you're spinning dials randomly, okay, trying to set up a universe randomly. Well, you've got to spin two dials, let's say, one for the ground state energy level of beryllium nuclei and one for the ground state energy level of helium nuclei. And you spin the dials and you've got to get them both accurate to the current values to within 1%. Otherwise, you're going to have to find a completely different way of having living things, which are basically a water-filled sack of carbon. Sorry to break the news to you. Remember, I told you had to pretend you're a materialist. It's really painful, isn't it? But you can't have life as we understand it without carbon, and you need to spin the dials and really hit the jackpot on the roulette wheel to get it right. 1%. Keep that figure in your mind. But that's nothing. Consider the ratio of the strong nuclear force to the electromagnetic force constant. Sorry, electromagnetic force constant. You're spinning the dials again, randomly trying to create a universe. Can you imagine what you're doing? Like some science genius with all hair and stuff flying around in your big spaceship. And you have got to get these two constants right in relation to one another to within one part in 10 to the 16, which is 100 million millionth of 1%. How do you fancy your chances? Spinning the roulette wheels, especially what you're doing. That's nothing. The electromagnetic force constant and the gravitational force constant, you've got to get your aim right to within one part in 10 to the 40. Now, your eyes are all starting to glaze over, so I need to explain what one part in 10 to the 40 means. You're randomly trying to create a universe now just by spinning the dials. What are the chances of getting it right if it's one part in 10 to the 40? That's one in one with 40 zeros. 100 billion, 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 billionth of 1%. Now, imagine, this is what we need to know, I need an illustration. Oh, I've got a coin today. Normally I don't have a coin with me, so I have to ask somebody to borrow one. It's a magician trick. Can I borrow a 10-pound note now, please, sir? So I want you to imagine you cover, I need you to go to America to do this, you need to cover the whole of Texas with coins like this, like next to each other on the ground, in a little kind of tiled pattern, tessellated pattern. And you cover the whole of Texas with coins and keep going beyond the boundaries of Texas into Arizona and New Mexico and then up north through all those states that are always coloured red and then up right to the border of Canada and then keep going all the way up to Alaska. And you cover the whole of North America with coins like this. And then you do it again. And you've got two layers of coins all covering the whole of North America. Then you do it again, three layers, again, 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 again. Keep going until your coins about pile is about up to here. It's quite heavy now. America's sinking. And you keep going, and you keep going until the pile is, well, until the pile reaches to the moon. Okay? Then you need to go find yourself another continent about the same size, and you need to do the same thing again. Coins, 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 pile reaching to the moon. You need to do that with a billion continents the size of North America. And then you need to paint this coin bright red and hide it in one of the piles. And then you find Mark and you blindfold him and you challenge him to pick it out. Blindfold. And the chance of him getting it right first time is about 1 part in 10 to the 40. You start to see how stupendously lucky you need to get if this random universe creating exercise is going to work. But that's nothing. Seriously, that's nothing. One of the forgotten bits of science, and is happily forgotten by anybody who's ever studied it, is known as thermodynamics. Anybody ever studied thermodynamics? Remember? You know, just blank from your mind. Thermodynamics is a property of it's an aspect of physics and chemistry which deals with the behaviour of complex systems. If you have a room full of gas, it has gazillions and gazillions of molecules in it. You can't possibly analyse the movement of each molecule one at a time. That's too complicated. So what you do is you come up with a small number of properties which describe the behaviour of the molecules as a whole, like temperature, pressure, that sort of thing. Simple ways of describing it. Now, Roger Penrose is an Oxford mathematician, and he knows a little bit about thermodynamics. And so he says, well, if you are trying to work out, analyse the behaviour of a really, really complicated system, like the whole universe, thermodynamics would be just the thing to do it with, wouldn't it? You could specify and describe the properties of our universe with a fairly small number of numbers. So what you could do is you could calculate the total entropy. Don't worry about what entropy is if you don't know what it is. I'll explain the implications of this in a second. Calculate the total entropy of the universe now, which you can do if you're Roger Penrose. And then what you do is you say, well, let's assume that it's 13.7 billion years old. And then you extrapolate backwards and you work out, because the entropy of the universe is gradually increasing. So you work out, if you go back 13.7 billion years, what value would the entropy of the universe have to have had? Let's say just after the Big Bang. Let Stephen Hawking cheat with the time at the beginning of it and so on. Just after the Big Bang, what value would the entropy of the universe have had at that point? And then you can do something really cool, because it turns out that thermodynamics allows you to predict how likely a system with a given entropy is to appear by chance. Can you see where we're going with this? So you could work out how likely it is statistically that the universe should have attained to the kind of structure and shape and properties and entropy, the configuration of all these different things, that it has just after the Big Bang, 13.7 billion years ago, if you believe that kind of stuff. And then you could work out the probability of such an event happening by chance. You ready? The probability is 1 part in 10 to the 123. Now remember what that means. 10 to the 40, I could scribble on, if we had a blackboard here, I could write it down in about 20 seconds. 1 with 40 zeros. And I did a conference a while back, got a kid to do this. And he was like, really? Yes. No, he wrote it down, longhand, in long decimal notation, 1 with 40 zeros. And I made him count them out. So, now, how would you write down 1 part in 10 to the 10 to the 123? Well, there are about 10 to the 80 atoms in the universe. So you'd have to find a way of writing a zero on every individual atom in the universe. But actually, because you're writing a zero in every atom, you wouldn't have to find a way of writing a zero on it. You could just say, well, let's let every zero in every atom in the universe stand for a zero. And then you line them up in a big long line and imagine a one in front of them, and it's one in... That's 1 in 10 to the 80. So then you'd need to do that again. Finally, you get yourself another universe, basically. Do that again and again and again and again and again and again and again. And do it one time for each of the coins in all of those piles of coins reaching to the moon. That would take you to 1 part in 10 to the 80 plus 40, 1 part in 10 to the 120. So you'd have a bit of a breather because you're 0.1% of the way there. To writing the number down. Not to calculating or having any sense of how stupendously improbable such an event is, if it's all down to chance. The bottom line is, as one physicist says, it kind of looks like this universe was designed. It doesn't have the sort of properties which make you think it came about by chance. To which I just want to say, explain how you account for this if you don't believe in a designer capable of intelligently putting together such a universe. It is quite easy to explain how an infinite God could accomplish such a feat. Which, incidentally, that then backfires on us, because we have such a puny, pathetic idea of what God is like. You know, when you think of God in those kind of terms, it's like Psalm 19. It's like, which is to my eyes anyway. The heavens declare the glory of God. Anyway, so. And we have this kind of puny, shrunk-down idea, so we need to go and do that on Saturday night in the pub and then preach again on Sunday and think. We need to find a way of bringing a people face-to-face with a God like that. That to one side, excuse me. You just go to your non-Christian friend and say, how do you explain it? How do you explain it? And there are two answers that they customarily give. We've got 7 minutes. Let me give them quickly. The first answer is the so-called anthropic principle. which is the kind of the funniest. The way the anthropic principle works is like this. It's no surprise that the universe has the properties it has, however finely balanced they are, to support life. Because if it didn't, we wouldn't be here to observe it. You see where this is going, right? So given that we're here to observe the universe, it's 100% certain that the universe is capable of supporting life, living things like us. Well, yeah, you can see this kind of backwards, but you get kind of tangled and lost in the details. So let me try and give you an illustration which explains what's wrong with it. Imagine you're standing in front of a firing squad, and you've got 50 guys there, all with rifles, trained on your chest from 10 metres away, and you refuse the blindfold, so you just close your eyes, and you hear a loud bang, and then you're surprised to discover that you can open your eyes, and you're still alive. Here's the question. Should you be surprised? Right, now here's a funny thing. The anthropic principle would say, well, no, you shouldn't be surprised, because given that you can open your eyes, there's a 100% chance that you're going to be alive. But you can see the confusion that's happened, can't you? The confusion that has happened is between the unlikelihood of the event itself and the unlikelihood that, given that the event happened, you'd be there to see it. Or, given that you were there to see it, that the event must have happened, which amounts to the same thing. In one sense, given that you could open your eyes, it's not at all surprising to find that you're alive. But on the other hand, it's stupendously surprising to find that you're still alive, because these guys are professionals, one of them should have hit you. So the surprising thing is not that we're here to observe the universe, but that the universe exists at all. The anthropic principle is one great big long Wikipedia article length logical fallacy. That's the first answer to this fine-tuning argument. The second is the multiple universes argument, which I mention simply because it gives an indication of the desperation to which physicists are driven. What actually happens is that competent theoretical mathematical physicists realise the significance of this conundrum. How stupendously unlikely it is that a universe like ours could exist in such a way that it allows stars and life to exist and so on. So what they say is, well, it would be a problem if there was only one universe. But let's suppose there are many, 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 many universes. After all, if you've got 10 to the 123 chances, then you're going to hit the right answer once, and we happen to live in the once. Which sounds all very well until you realise the implications. What they have been driven to is to postulate the existence of something which could never conceivably be proved, for which no other evidence could conceivably exist, namely another universe. No evidence for another universe could possibly exist in this universe, because if it did, it wouldn't be another universe, it'd be part of this one. In other words, what they've done is, in order to try and solve this problem, they've had to posit something as fantastically complicated, not as just one more universe, but 10 to the 123 more universes, for which there is no evidence whatsoever. It's not a scientific hypothesis at all, actually. It's a philosophical last resort which simply served to show that they recognise rightly how serious the problem is. And even if it were true, what it would do would be to deal with 0.4 out of 8. It wouldn't help you with all the other things that we've talked about already. The mind, morality, and all the things we're going to talk about after the break. So then, those are four of the four of the things which it seems to me we could factor into our apologetics to enable us to witness and commend the gospel and to commend the Christian faith and to commend the Christian view of the world to people who are atheists and materialists and think differently from us. We've got a few minutes for questions before 11 o'clock, so go ahead if you've got any questions or comments. For clarification, or want to take things further, yeah, John, isn't it?
Yeah. Hi, John. Thank you very much. That's really helpful. Just very quickly, your comments on the probability against existence of the universe are focused on it coming into existence.
Right. Yes.
My guess is that similar arguments could be given for its development as well since then, which would be another response with it to the multiverses idea, to say, well, even if that was the case, the probability of it continuing in such a way that it's brought about the universes we have is very small. Is that something that people have engaged in at all?
Yeah, and so there's the issue, it's not just the origin of the universe and that the unlikelihood of that, but its development subsequently. Yes, it's certainly something that people have been interested in, physicists and astrophysicists, the development of the cosmos since its earliest days. So there's a whole bunch of literature about that, which I'm less familiar with, in truth. Of course, the one place where development has really been the centre of people's attention has been in the development, not of the universe per se, but of biological life. So evolution is an attempt to account for the emergence of stuff like you and me and amoebas and shrimps and cockroaches out of basically carbon and muck and inanimate things. So, and that we'll say something about that a bit later. I'm not sure whether the same kinds of statistical analyses have been performed on the development of the cosmos as such. They may well have been. The neat thing about these arguments is that they take you back to some fairly basic statements about the properties of the universe and the state that it must have had according to a standard cosmological model just after the Big Bang. And those don't rely on complexities and debates about how it subsequently developed. Thank you. Yeah. Question at the back, yeah.
Can you just give us a bit of help, because you had an assumption that the mind was inexplicable, which you kind of assumed, I think. Just give us a bit of help in explaining why it's inexplicable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, thank you. So the claim that the mind is inexplicable is something I assumed, yeah. Sorry, thank you for drawing attention to that. What I'm doing is summarising in about five words the state of the literature as I see it among non-Christians in philosophy working on the mind. And basically that you've got all these attempts. Let me say a bit about it, try and piece some thoughts together. On the one hand, you have lots of attempts to explain how mental phenomena, like whatever's going on when you listen to Mozart, or pain, that's a really big one, how they correlate with physiological changes. So you've got a kind of real-time brain scanner and some quite funky techniques for seeing where the blood goes and stuff. And what people notice is if you play somebody music, you see different patterns on the scanner from if you hit somebody on the thumb with a hammer. And they don't do that kind of experiment, but you get the picture. Okay, well, that's great. I mean, and it's fantastic. It's not entirely surprising. It's a bit like if you're a mechanic, and you have somebody who comes in and says, I want to train to be a mechanic, and I think I know about how a car works, because I notice if I drop a ton of bricks on the bonnet, the engine turns off. That's basically what's going on. You notice that if you apply some external stimulus, you observe some change, so to speak, in the output. That doesn't tell you anything about the inner workings of the car engine. So simply to observe the physiology of the human brain, or the spinal cord, or whatever, doesn't tell you about what the mind is, or how it relates to the mind. And what's interesting to me is that the secular world, in its discussions of this issue, seems to be divided into two camps. You've got scientists, experimental scientists and physiologists, who are quite optimistic about their chances of their brain scanners that they've did their PhD on, and now they're developing. They think that will work. And then you've got philosophers, like Thomas Nagel and Jerry Fodor, who don't have a cat in the experimental science game. They're saying, look, it's just obvious. You don't have a clue, do you? And I think you've got a clash of presuppositions and worldviews, where the people who have nothing to lose by telling the truth are telling the truth. We don't know what's going on. I think Jerry Fodor says, nobody knows, none of us know what it means to be conscious. None of us actually knows what it would mean to know that we are conscious, or to understand that we are conscious. We are that far away from understanding even what we're talking about. So it's, what I'm trying to give you is a sense of that when you think a thought, you are doing something that is stupendously complex and subtle and is just not on the same page as the physical phenomena that we observe and kind of understand. And historically, I think you can explain that because of the 17th century compromise, where Descartes, Galileo, their contemporaries and successors said, well, let's not try and deploy these scientific tools to explain the mind. Obviously, they're not going to do that. But they might explain the physical world. Yeah, and then you leave the mind to one side for a later day.
Was that at all helpful, Graham?
It was at all helpful.
Yeah. Thanks. Okay.
I suppose the challenge some of us might face is some body said that can change character and behaviour by brain damage or something.
Yeah, definitely.
It must just mean it's mechanical.
Right. And I think okay, fair enough. What that means is there is some kind of connection between the physical organism and its thoughts, feelings, emotions, temperaments, which is, we would have expected the mind and the body to be related. That doesn't tell us what the mind is. It's a very different thing to say, if I take a drug, it makes me feel happy. If I drink too much, it makes me feel tired and sleepy, and my thoughts get all confused. It's a very different thing from noticing that, which is important and useful, from actually telling me this is not a trite question, what is love? What is a thought? And even to ask that question in that way reveals that the normal predicates that we apply in scientific contexts, what is a da da da, just don't seem to be the right tools for even describing this phenomenon of mental activity. Thank you. We got a whole bunch of questions, but I'm happy to carry on talking.
Should,
it's after 11.
One more before coffee, and then Steve can decide if he wants to do more questions after coffee.
Do you want me to pick the first one I saw, or do you want to pick one?
Let's go for whoever thinks they've got the most exciting, interesting question. We should let David ask, really, because it's his part.
Yeah, go on, David, yeah, yeah.
It might not be the most exciting. Just getting on the whole right and wrong thing, your philosophical burglar. If you say to the burglar, you share the same kind of basic subjective view, but you say, but we live in a society where we have together agreed, the majority of people agree with me,
right,
that you are wrong and I'm right, and therefore I'm going to call the police, and guess what? They're going to agree.
They agree too, yeah. Right, so what do you do at that point? Okay, so that's probably what would happen if you managed to avert the fight. So, but there, at the philosophical level, there are several problems with that. Firstly, who said the democracy is a good thing? And that's an ethical stance. So who cares if the majority voted? Secondly, if the majority voted, who said social contract theory is right, whereby I happen to be bound by the will of the majority? And I think that's a nonsense myself. So that's the second problem. The third problem is the thought experiment that you get where the burglar says, okay, I'll concede your point here. But before you call the police, could you imagine a culture that thought differently? A culture in which, let's say, enough people agreed that Jews ought to be gassed, or at least imprisoned and made to wear little badges. Would that make that right? And by the logic that you've accepted, the answer is yes. So what you've done is you've averted the temporary problem of the philosophical burglar and created rather larger problems whenever you go to another culture in the world that thinks differently from you. Because in the end, we want to say not just that some people are wrong, but some cultures are wrong. And if you think culture defines ethics, you can't ever say a culture is wrong. So then, I think, I mentioned it before, it was horrific to mention it again, but I think you should mention it. You should mention female genital mutilation in evangelistic talks. Let's not stop pussyfooting around the issue, right? That's where the rubber hits the road, not in some silly philosophy seminar where you've got undergraduates who think they're smart enough to develop their own philosophical systems. That's what actually happens. And people need to be confronted, I know you're not disagreeing with this, people need to be confronted with the horror of a society that basically agrees. You know, they've got a beautifully well-constructed moral norm which works well for all the guys. Yeah, it's horrible, isn't it? And I think if you see the look on the faces of the non-Christians that I see on your faces, that's a good thing to have done.